Welcome to the Digital Families Podcast. Back from holidays, I'm Leonie Smith, sometimes known as the Cyber Safety Lady. I'm a cyber safety educator, and this podcast is all about learning how to use the digital technology in our homes with more safety and balance. My guest today is someone I've had on Digital Families twice before. Michelle has such an amazing insight into parenting that I'm constantly recommending her to parents who need good, straight-talking advice about their children's issues. Michelle Mitchell is an author, speaker, and advocate for families and parenting teenagers. She is the author of two new books, A Girl's Guide to Puberty and A Guy's Guide to Puberty. Michelle is also a mother of two teenagers and lives in Brisbane, Australia. Michelle, welcome back to the Digital Families Podcast.
Hey, Leonie, it's such a privilege to be here again. We love our chats, don't we?
Well, I hope the audience loves them as well, and I'm sure they do, because I always learn so much from talking to you, Michelle.
Well, that's very kind, and I enjoy talking to you as well. It's always insightful.
Michelle, tell us, why did you write these two books? I understand that they actually were in the pipeline for a couple of years.
Oh, a lot of years, and I actually held myself back from writing them for a long time because I'm not a sexologist and I don't have a medical background, but a big part of my work in schools has been in this area of sexual health. But I think working with teenagers for so long, you start to look at some of the risky choices they do make around 14, 15, 16 years old. And I started to think, how can we get more preventative about this? And how can we really step into this space a little bit earlier? Because research is telling us that it's often too little, too late with our kids. And over 50% of our kids are saying to us they want us to talk more. Now, on a personal note, Leonie, if I said to my kids, do you think I talk to you enough about, you know, sex and all that stuff? They'd probably say no. But I felt like I was talking a lot.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how much our kids really do want us to have these conversations and need us to have these conversations with them. And if we're waiting until they're high school, we're kind of missing the mark. Puberty doesn't start when a girl first gets her periods or our boys start to smell a bit more and get a bit more hair. It actually starts a few years before that. And so now we're talking about puberty starting internally around that 8 years old mark.
Do you find that it depends on whether they're a girl or boy as to whether they're more open to talking about it? I found with my boys, it was like pulling teeth. You know, every time I tried to have a talk to them, it was like, I know all this, Mum, rolling eyes, or hiding under the covers with fingers in the ears going, la, 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 la.
And with our boys, sometimes they hit that mark where their ego's on the line with it, and you're not just talking about a body, you're talking about their body. And they are forming those boundaries of trust and intimacy. And so I think we have to be incredibly respectful about those lines in our kids' lives and not be giving them mixed messages. I think a part of these conversations, they need to have a lot of choice in it. It has to be really respectful of their journey. But as far as schools go, no, I don't think I can personally say that I think girls or boys are more open. I think boys are often younger. They're sometimes a little more giggly. And girls have this ability with their language a little more developed to lean into conversations about me and who I am. Mm. Whereas, you know, boys are often about 18 months behind. They are just probably that little bit more apprehensive around these conversations.
So tell us about the books, Michelle. Who are they for? They're actually for the kids and not so much the parents, or do you find the parents are reading them through as well?
They are.
Because I was thinking that when I got them, I looked at them. First of all, the books, thank you very much for posting them out to me, the two books. They're absolutely gorgeous. The covers are just so sweet. And I had them sitting near the door back here on my study, and one of my boys came in and saw the Boy's Guide to Puberty really did a double take and like, Mum, isn't this just too late? You know? Because he's like 21. He said, I think we've missed the boat with this one. I said, it's for work. He did look quite curious at it, though, and I'm sure he would have learnt a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen older kids pick them up and go, like, what did I miss out on when I was 8 to 12? We didn't have this when we were younger.
Yeah.
And they sort of come at it with this real, I wish I had have had that resource. I wish someone had have been talking to me. Because they can feel a little estranged in their own bodies sometimes, can't they? It's such a big change and such a lot of growth in a short amount of time. And I think we need to be aware that for some of our kids, those changes happen quite in such a dense period of time, and for other kids it's more drawn out, and they're all very conscious of, you know, if they're the first or the last to start puberty or where they're falling within the time frame of it all, and they're becoming more socially aware too. So it's a big time for our kids. So they're for 8 to 12 year olds, drawing off research saying that that is really the time for this information update. Now, we want to be talking to our kids all the way through. Mm. And a lot of parents are about body parts and body safety and all the rest of it. But there is this time where it comes, this moment in their lives where I call it the information update, that we're using the information we've already given them and we're building on it specifically in preparation for these teenage years and making sure that they have that early education, because there's two benefits, Leonie. One is it helps our kids make wiser choices during adolescence. And I wonder whether that research is also pointing the fact that they had one trusted adult to orientate them that actually helps those wiser choices as well. So I question whether it's just the education. I actually think it's more than the education. I think it's us coming to the table with this open heart and willingness to guide our kids through this bumpy little journey. The second benefit is that it helps our kids adapt to this change. And I'm really excited about this one because it boosts their resilience. So research tells us that early education, talking early and often, and walking beside them with medically accurate information is going to help them be more adaptive and bounce through this a little easier than get too caught up with the intensity of it.
Your books, Michelle, are really detailed. I was having a flick through again today.
Yeah.
And they are incredibly detailed, as much as even going into as much detail as explaining exactly how girls can use a period pad, for instance, that it's got a sticky bit on the back and it's got these little wings and this is where
I've
it goes.
Yeah.
Show them to the cat.
I'll see if I can flick it up while we're talking.
Yeah. I'm really
conscious that some kids don't get that information.
So I've had... Are you finding that the girls aren't even sharing it amongst themselves as well?
They do.
Because I think that's what, like, when I think about me growing up, I got some advice from my mum that seemed really old-fashioned, but it was my friends that told me about... Yeah, exactly.
Change a pad.
Gorgeous cartoons, and it's such a lovely, funny... They're actually very... The way you've written it is really funny as well.
Growing up's meant to be fun. It's got to be fun.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really good humour in there, Michelle, and I love the way that you've written it so that you're kind of using similar language to what the kids might use themselves as well.
Yeah. I'm really conscious when I go into schools that some kids don't have sort of like the information update chat with their parents, and sometimes they have that chat too late, and sometimes there's some real cultural and even religious things that impact how that chat's had. And I also noticed too that some girls are living with their dads, and so their dads might not feel equipped or comfortable wading into those areas. So we want to, as trusted adults supporting kids, give our kids really medically accurate information and make sure we don't patronize tweens. They have some really solid questions about their health, and the questions I get asked by little ones in schools are highly intelligent and very attuned to their bodies, and we want to meet that with the level of respect it deserves.
So that leads me to my next question, which is, puberty happens around the same time as the introduction to social media, Michelle. How much influence is social media and the internet having on our children's learning about their bodies and about puberty and sexuality, and what kind of effect is that having?
Okay, what I think they are learning is what a teenager looks like And that concerns me greatly. Mm-hmm. So if I flick on TikTok and I start scrolling through, tweens are looking at big girls, or they're looking at, you know, the big boys, and they get this image of what it means to be a teenager. And that's not always a very healthy image. That really concerns me. And pictures speak louder than words, especially, I think, on their devices. And so they're getting these images of what it is to look beautiful, or, you know, to be popular, or whatever it be. And mm-hmm. I think they absorb that a lot more than we realize. The other thing with technology and puberty is that it's a time where they become more curious.
Mm-hmm.
And research is really telling us that this generation of kids is much more curious than we were. And so when they have these really legitimate questions based on maybe what they see in this highly sexualized world that they live in, or what they hear from their peers, or even what they're going through personally, they're seeking answers. And we want to channel that curiosity to safe people and safe places. And the internet's not one of those. And unfortunately, a lot of our kids are learning or going to the internet for answers to their questions if they feel uncomfortable bringing it up at home.
Yeah, and the algorithm is determining as to what they find. It's interesting that you said that they're more curious. And I was trying to think back to why that might be, just through my own experience of my childhood. And I imagine it's because when we were growing up, Michelle, we had a lot of boundaries around what we could talk about at home.
Yeah,
so there was like, you know, there was a definite adult world and a definite child world, and kids just didn't talk about these things, and parents certainly wouldn't talk about them. So because our children have been brought up to ask all kinds of questions all the time. I mean, there was a time when I'm like, no more questions, please. You know, that has fostered that feeling of curiosity. But the other thing we also know, Michelle, is that there's a really big problem with kids accessing pornography online earlier and earlier, and the research is certainly bearing this out. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the impact of children as young as being in primary school accessing really hardcore pornography through games, through social media. What does that do to their perception of sexuality and their own bodies and the expectations?
Yeah, that's right. And when their first sexual sort of experience is one online, it does really very much shape what they think sex is, and what they start to perceive a relationship as being, and what this whole adult world looks like. And there's a vast difference between, you know, fact and fiction, and pornography is entertainment, isn't it? And it doesn't represent real life, but our kids don't know that. And so with our young ones either stumbling across it or searching for it, I feel like we need a safety plan, Leonie, and I feel like we need to get in ahead and really think about, if they're old enough to be accessing technology, they have to be old enough for us to be talking to them about the risks, and also giving them a plan. It's not if they're going to see it, it's what they do when they do see it. And making sure they're really, really clear on the process and procedure that they can follow or should follow if they stumble across something online.
Yeah,
the research used to be 11 and a half, didn't it, for access or for early exposure. But now it's looking like more like 8. Is that correct?
They haven't done enough research, Michelle. So anytime I've gone to look for the answer to that question you just had, I've found that they actually haven't come up with new research yet. And I think a lot of it has to do with the sensitivity around the issue and actually getting honest answers from people. So one of the things I talk about in my talks is what I call this conspiracy of silence, where kids aren't telling parents or teachers about what their experiences are. Teachers and educators aren't talking about it amongst children and parent bodies because of all kinds of safety and privacy reasons. And then you've got, you know, parents not telling anyone because of they feel absolutely awful that their child's been exposed to it. So no one really knows how many children are being exposed. It's a guessing game. And the thing is, often children are exposed and they don't have the language to even explain to an adult that they have been what they've seen. So they just shut down.
That's right. And it's traumatizing for them, isn't it? Like when they're, it really is. I have been surprised how many times I've been in a primary school classroom teaching about puberty and the conversations that follow. In other words, the kids that come up to me afterwards and start talking to me about other personal things like, I saw a picture online last night, or someone said this to me, or Miss, what do you think about TikTok? Because there's this person doing this. And it almost opens the door for these other really important conversations and lays a foundation and builds a platform of trust. So our kids know that there really isn't anything off limits. There's appropriate times and places to talk about things.
Yep.
That's important.
Yeah.
But if we channel that curiosity, and we don't ever want to shut that down, it's a healthy thing, but we channel it to the right places in the right times, it helps keep them safe.
I just want to tag on to that, which is my next thought, which is also that some children are actually using the internet to explore their sexuality, and it might be that parents are totally unaware of their children's sexual identity and could be very surprised to find that child on, for instance, like a gay dating app or something like that. How can parents help children through this sometimes confusing time that's part of their self-discovery and part of puberty and all those sorts of issues, Michelle?
Because we didn't have the internet when we were younger, it's really hard for us to understand how kids can, and I'll give you another example, make two or three profile accounts of two very different people. And when you're talking about an algorithm finding that person and giving that person more content of what they like, I'm surprised how many young people do have different profiles and use them in that way, because adolescence is a time where they're trying on different identities. But for us as parents, having not explored adolescence with technology in our hands, it's all very foreign to us. And I think the fear that comes with that to parents is huge. If they're not continually weighing in with these really open-hearted conversations that recognize sometimes kids are going to have very, very different ideas than we want them to. And really, bottom line, at the end of the day, and I'm talking about high school kids now, if we can't keep an open dialogue with them through that journey, someone else is really walking beside them. And that's a challenge when their ideas are in conflict with the values we want to teach them around sexuality.
And of course, there can be a good side that to that also, Michelle, is that people can find their own tribe. And you might have a child, for instance, from a very a family that has really strong cultural or religious objections to a child's difference in sexuality. And that child then finds their own tribe online, which they never would have done before the internet.
That's right. Now, the challenge with that is that doesn't replace the need for a real life tribe, but it is another element or attachment and or extension of kids' lives that they didn't have to tap into previously. And I see this really being helpful for kids who are struggling socially at school. Sometimes they do find their tribe within a gaming, you know, clan, where they are able to interact with kids where they feel like they belong, and that can be a healthy thing. It's just keeping them in touch with reality too, Leonie, that concerns me.
Yeah, so in your work, Michelle, with children that you do, and you do a lot of work in schools, what are some of the most common issues that children today are having in regards to the changes that they are going through in puberty and going into teenagers? What do you see as the most important issues that parents should be aware of?
I think body image is notorious for kind of really raising its head in that 8 to 12 year old bracket, and parents are always asking me how to handle it when their daughter says that she's fat, or you know, or that their son's looking at his legs and going, my legs look like twigs, you know, and or why have I got hair growing out of my toes, you know. So this is real self-consciousness that comes, and self-awareness that starts to come around them, and they can very much compare themselves to everyone else. And it can manifest in all sorts of ways. It can manifest in our kids bullying or judging each other, like girls, whether they've shaved their legs or not, you know. And it's so important to keep reinforcing at that age that it's their body and their choice. And I'm really for parents giving kids a range of options when it comes to hygiene and even women's hygiene products. So kids can really start to take ownership and explore for themselves how they'd like to probably take care of this growing body of theirs. Because I think just putting one size fits all for kids these days is not working. And they need to feel empowered in that journey of growing up.
Have you seen a big change, Michelle, over your time doing this from the advent of social media on those issues where, body issues? Because, I mean, that's the research that we're seeing is that particularly with apps like Instagram and girls will get onto Instagram and create an account that they think will turn them into an influencer of some kind and themselves in a certain light. And so what kinds of impacts are you seeing to do with that?
I hear this from parents all the time, that their child has grand ideas about, you know, wanting to be a YouTuber and wanting to have lots of followers or a big platform.
Yeah.
And they're wanting to do that like 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and their parents feel like they're holding the reins on something that could be, they don't know what they're messing with. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And even when they're looking at kids on TikTok and saying, oh, that looks cool, or I'd like to be like that, it's almost like, it's like 5 or 6 years too young most of the time. And they're trying to put themselves in these big people's shoes without the cognitive maturity to even understand what they're looking at. And that, you know, worries me when it comes to pornography, it comes to everything. What we know about teen sexuality, what concerns me is that we can't just put that into educating tweens and expect it to work, because tweens' brains are in a completely different space and they are processing things very cognitively, and they need concrete examples to really live with information maturely. And whereas the research is saying it's too little too late with the way we're talking to our teenagers about sexuality and they're having sexual experiences without the full education behind them, we can't just plonk that backwards 2 or 3 years and expect it to work. We have to have such sensitivity with young ones, even with the way we talk to them about pornography. Yes, we need to talk to them early, but gosh, we need to do it in a way that's not overexposing them, and that they can still have their childhood in and amongst all that.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And it leads me into my next question. I did a webinar 2 nights ago with parents, and one of the regular questions that comes up from parents in my webinars, and it came up a lot in this particular webinar, was around the peer group pressure to be on adult apps. So if we're talking about TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat, for instance, primarily, the parents were asking me, Michelle, how do they deal with that peer group pressure for their children to be on these apps? The parents actually don't want them on the apps. They do understand, particularly after they've heard my talk, what the downsides of having a child too early on an adult app can be. But their main concern is that their child doesn't get ostracized or bullied from not being allowed on these apps. So I mentioned to you before we went live, I would really love your opinion on this, but I think sometimes for parents, setting boundaries around this adult space is the first time they've really had to do it. And that if they can get some kind of a plan going now, or some philosophy around it, by the time they hit the age of 13 and 14, when kids are starting to get offered, you know, drugs or alcohol or first sexual experiences, they'll already in their heads know the direction they need to go in to be able to cope with those fears around peer group pressure. So what would you say in answer to that, Michelle?
There's so much in this. Should we just try and unpack it for parents? Because this right here is the biggest challenge that I find a lot of upper primary school parents are facing, because it's the first time they felt that really intense peer group pressure come into their home in a way that's like a hurricane. And they're like, oh gosh, am I disadvantaging my child, or do I need to say a firm no here? And it can almost kind of take parents unexpectedly. And it's the first time they're really making those kind of calls for their kids about firsts. I call it firsts. I've got a blog post about how parents can assess whether it's time for one of those first things to happen. And it can be things like catching public transport by themselves or having a social media account or whatever. Family values are so diverse, and I think the longer I'm in this field, I'm realizing that everyone, especially around this topic that we're talking about, Leonie, is bringing a different perspective. And I think it's so important to wade into it without judgment and with a lot of compassion, because I see some families whose kids are on technology a lot, and they're actually making it work and keeping their kids safe within the process, but they have the open conversations and the older brothers and sisters and all these dynamics that make that work. For a lot of parents, that is not a scenario they want to wade into in their home. And when their child says, "I'm the only one who doesn't have," chances are they're not the only one, but the tide's starting to tip against them socially and they're becoming aware of it. So let me describe what I see when I go into grade 5 and 6 classrooms. In grade 5, about a quarter to a third of kids are already on social media, have their own accounts. Mm-hmm. In grade 6, that's about half of kids are on social media and have their own accounts. Mm-hmm. And parents need to be aware that when their kids say, "My friends are on social media," it's actually true. You know, so they're not fabricating something.
Yeah.
Now, if a parent thinks that, no, that is not the right thing to do. And look, if you've got a child on social media under the age of, 13 for the majority of apps, you have to own that account and be using it with them. Otherwise, you're opening them up to a world of risks. And technology is not a babysitter, and it needs to be filtered, and it needs to come with our supervision and education. But as they get 11, 12, 13, socially, so much of their world is online. I have parents whose kids are 12, 13, and they're saying, "Look, do I keep saying no? What do I do?" And I have to say to them this: look, developmentally, where they're at socially is everything for them right now. And so somehow I want you to work out a way that they can interact with their friends safely and you feel like they can stay safe, and develop a plan for your home, because this is not an issue that's going to go away, and it's not an issue that I think parents can say no to forever. I feel like there has to be some way to preempt that this is the inevitable. Eventually, here, they're going to want to communicate with their friends online. And how does that need to look for our home? There's so much in this, Leonie.
Yeah, I know. But it doesn't actually address the whole peer group pressure thing, Michelle. So as a parent of 4 adult children now, that was obviously an issue that came up for me in several different ways. And some kids had very little problem with it. I have to say to parents, it's not all kids that really suffer with peer group pressure. Some kids just say, "I don't care, I don't want to do it," you know, and they have the fortitude to withstand that. And the other kids often won't even have a go at them because they know it's not going to get anywhere. Whereas other kids really, really want to be part of those groups, whatever it is, whether it's sleepovers, drugs and alcohol, particular things they want to wear or whatever it is. So on the longer term, how does a parent deal with those fears around the fact that their child is asking for something that they know it's too soon for them to do that thing, whatever it might be, and the fears around that child then being kicked out of the group or being teased or bullied?
So there's our fears as a parent, and we need to be really realistic about whether our fears are justified or not, and how much we're exaggerating those fears. I find children who are the firstborn cop the brunt of their parents' fears a lot more. And so we're a lot stricter with our first kids. You know what I mean.
Hey? And a bit more mollycoddling at times, you know, Michelle.
We're more cautious, and you know what we say yes to really quickly with our second and third and fourth, like, you know, we were very serious about with our first. And so I think we do need to assess how realistic our fears are, and also make sure that we're empowering our kids that with every new freedom that we give them, there's a responsibility and accountability that comes with that. And we make room for mistakes, but they become learning opportunities to guide our kids through this journey. Now, when we have to say no to a child for safety reasons, and we don't think it's the right time or place for that experience, parents have to be prepared to hold the fort. And they have to actually understand that developmentally, our kids' drive to attach to their peers is so high. Mm. And what we know about brain development and even the different ages that our kids hit puberty, and sometimes those hormone changes come in a really intense block. Mm. So they have a heightened intensity to needing to connect with their peers because those changes are happening very quickly. Mm. So they go through this intense up to 3-year gap, but it's normally 18 months. Parents feel like they're holding on for dear life. What we know about brain development helps us be compassionate with the no. We can say no in an authoritative way, or we can say no soft and close in a way that enables us to still honour and validate how important it is for our kids to connect socially and offer as much replacement as we possibly can in those scenarios.
Mm. It is a big one. I've still got like another 10 questions I wanted to ask you. We've run out of time. And I think we'll come back to this whole peer group pressure issue again another time, because I can see that's a major problem for me. It's a major problem for me in my work to try and help parents to understand the online world when parents are so fearful of the fact that their child may miss out or suffer for not being allowed to do that. And I know other people that work in similar spaces of drug and alcohol education have the same issues, exactly the same issues. It's been really great talking to you, as usual, Michelle. I could, you know, talk to you for at least another half an hour on this stuff. I hope parents are getting heaps out of this conversation. Where can people find out more about your work? Where can they get these amazing books? Just show them again on the screen. They are just fantastic.
They're so fun.
They are lots of fun and really unique, and everybody loves them. They're just so great. I had a giveaway of those books I think end of last year, and they just went off like a rocket.
Should we do another one, Leonie?
Oh, I'd love to. They actually
Should we do that?
As soon as I launched it, within seconds people had claimed them. So
yay.
Okay, so how do you want to do it, Michelle? If somebody once I put this up on Facebook.
Yes, what do you want to do? We'll give away one of each.
Okay, one of each. The first person who watches this video all or listens to this podcast all the way to the end, we'll get the giveaway. Just
do they have to comment? How will we know?
Yeah? Just DM me on my Facebook.
Oh, awesome.
And yes, I'll put them in touch with you, and you can send them out to
me. Post it out.
Really generous of you. Thank you so much, Michelle.
My pleasure.
You have a great day up there in sunny Brisbane. I hope you're going to have a really nice Easter now that you're allowed out.
No, we're out of lockdown,
which is great. And I'm going to speak to you soon, and this will be up probably overnight. And it's just been great talking to you, Michelle. And is there anything else you'd like to say before we say goodbye?
Oh, just back yourselves, parents. You're doing a better job than you think you are. And it can be tough, these decisions. There's no judgment. You just do the best as you can. But as much as you can grow and learn as a person, it oozes off into your kids.
Fantastic words of wisdom there to live by, Michelle. Great. Lovely to see you. And I'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Sounds great.
If any of these issues mentioned have raised any concerns, you can contact Beyond Blue on 1-300-224-636, Lifeline on 13 11 14, or the Kids Helpline Parent Line. They've got an amazing parent line at 1300 1352. Thanks for listening to the Digital Families Podcast. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review and or some feedback on the YouTube channel or your favorite podcast app, and subscribe. Tell your friends to subscribe. I'd love to hear what you think. Maybe you've got a suggestion for an upcoming guest, and tune in again for our next podcast for our chat about all things digital and how it affects families. Thank you so much.